7. Seeing the Simmons house and hearing Sandy's stories about Frank got me thinking. Before this moment, I had never had any desire to return to Randall. But now I was curious. I wanted to see the town. I wanted to see our old vacation home. I wanted to find out more about Frank. There it was. I didn't know why, or what I could possibly hope to learn, but maybe if I saw those locations through adult eyes, from a more worldly perspective, I'd find something out about the man that I hadn't known before. There was a nagging feeling at the back of my brain, a sense that if I could understand who Frank was, or why he did what he did, I might be able to find him, and make sure he was punished for his crimes. For Billy. There was a definite pattern, I realized after talking to Sandy Simmons. All of Frank's houses incorporated stolen materials, and all of them had bodies or bones buried somewhere within their construction. It was a thing with him. And that led me to the part of all this that I didn't want to think about. The supernatural part. I was not a skeptic. No realtor is. We've all had encounters with properties that seemed off somehow. That didn't feel right. Houses where we didn't want to spend time alone. Where we quickly put up our signs, set out our flyers, and left as fast as possible. But this was less vague, more specific. And the fact that these hauntings, for lack of a better word, were connected to a single person, Frank, made me feel distinctly uneasy. But no less determined to get to the bottom of it. So I thought I'd take a few days off and drive back to Randall. That was the good thing about being a realtor. The hours were flexible. It had been a tough summer, and I was still treading water financially, but the commission from the Big Bear cabin sale, as small as it was, allowed me at least a little leeway. And once my end of the paperwork was completed and filed, I intended to take a short research trip. 2 days later, my work done, I decided to speed over to Randall on Friday, returning on Sunday, thinking that would give me enough time to snoop around and see what I could find without significantly impacting my job. I left the Lincoln at the office and took my van to meet Terry for lunch at Don Jose's, intending to tell her of my plans and explain why I had to break our date for Saturday. The Lincoln was a show car, meant to fool clients into thinking I was hugely successful and doing better than I was. Luxury cars, even crappy ones with rolled back odometers like mine, made prospective homebuyers feel comfortable. My actual ride was an 8-year-old Honda Odyssey. I'd bought the van because it was supposed to have a stellar safety record, but mine must have been made on a Monday since it had given me nothing but problems from the get-go. My previous vehicle, a Ford Explorer, had lasted over 200,000 miles before I decided to trade it in. But this pile of junk had barely half as many miles on it and had already had to have the motor mounts replaced twice. Last year, on a trip to San Diego, it had died right in front of the nuclear power plant at San Notre, and I'd had to wait 2 hours for a tow back to Orange, where I found out that it needed a new transmission. Oh, and a new front axle. When I told my tale of woe to Jim Gibbons at the office, who also happened to have a Honda van, he said, "Yeah, they do seem to have problems with their transmissions." As it turned out, his transmission had been recalled. But when I went online to see if there was a recall for my year, I found out that it was only for the 3 years prior. I was out of luck, and I had to shell out nearly $2,000 to have my axle replaced and my transmission rebuilt. The damn thing still made mysterious noises when I braked or when I accelerated, so I only drove the van locally. Since there was no way it would be able to get me all the way to Arizona, that meant I was going to have to rent a car for the weekend. Unless I suddenly had an idea. I could convince Terry to come with me, and we could go in her car. That was a big step, though. Maybe too big. Terry and I had met last year at the birthday party of a friend from college, had hit it off, and were now kind of, sort of, almost semi-dating. It was not really anything serious, but a weekend trip in her car would definitely kick the relationship up a few notches. And did I really want that? Did she really want that? Maybe it would be better to shell out the money for a rental car after all. Terry was already at the restaurant when I arrived, waiting for me on a bench outside the front door. She looked damn good, as she always did. And I gave her a quick kiss, put my arm around her waist, and we stepped inside. I ended up telling her about my visit to the Simmons house, and a little about Frank, and about my planned weekend trip to Randall. Apparently, she thought I was inviting her. "Oh, I wish I could go," she said. "But there's no way I can take off Friday. In fact, I may even have to come in on Saturday." Terry worked in the IT department of an Orange County-based bank. She put her hand on mine. "Maybe next time?" "That's okay," I told her. And then the waitress arrived, and we ordered. Rental car it was. I remembered large parts of the trip to Arizona. Landmarks. Specific gas stations, even. A McDonald's in Quartzsite, where we'd once stopped for lunch. A rest area where Billy had thrown up after seeing an overflowing urinal. The inspection station at the border, with its display case of desert bats and bugs. A lot had changed since I was a kid. The Phoenix area had grown tremendously and had spread much further into the desert than I would have expected. Subways and Walmarts crowding out Saguaro's and Ocotillo on new roads that led to new subdivisions. But the route to Randall was still a two-lane highway, and the town itself had changed hardly at all. On the way in, I saw signs for a new development, the Pines, that apparently offered luxury vacation homes to rich people from the valley. But that was an anomaly. The lack of jobs in this area had kept the town small, and it was still just as cute as I remembered it. A few of the businesses had changed. The video store was now a Starbucks, and the bakery was now a pizza restaurant. But the essential character of the downtown had remained the same. I drove slowly, looking for the turnoff to our old neighborhood, not positive I remembered where it was. Although the clouds in the sky were more white than gray, the streets were wet, and the air was filled with a unique scent I hadn't smelled since childhood. Forest rain. I rolled down the car window to better take it in, breathing deeply, feeling happy, feeling sad, recognizing the deep earthy odor of dirt, the lighter smell of fresh pine needles, the clean scent of water. All of it mingled together and suspended in a humidity that was comforting rather than heavy. It brought me back to those monsoon summers we'd spent at our vacation home. And though I'd come here in pursuit of information about Frank, I was suddenly overcome by memories of my dad, my mom, and my brother, filled with a feeling of loss so strong that I almost pulled the car over. At that moment, I saw our street, recognizing it by the ponderosa pine on the corner. Miraculously, it had not been chopped down, although the formerly vacant lot where it stood was now occupied by a two-story house with a two-car garage. I turned, heading up the winding road, past trees much taller than I recalled, and many more houses than I remembered. I rounded the curve where I'd fallen off my bike, glanced over at the ditch where Mark Goodwin had found the rotting body of a dead raccoon. A powerful sadness settled over me. I had not expected this reaction, and wondered if I should turn around and leave. Maybe coming here had been a mistake. Then I found our old house, and saw a camera crew out front, with trucks and lights and a crowd of technicians, and a group of neighborhood residents behind a barrier of sawhorses, watching it all. What was going on here? I pulled to a stop at the side of the road and got out of the car. A couple of heads turned my way, but I was not nearly as interesting as whatever was being filmed, and the few neighbors who'd noticed my arrival decided to ignore me. I walked up to a young man wearing a Weird Al Yankovic t-shirt. "What's going on?" I asked. He said that the crew in front of us was preparing to film an episode of Ghost Pursuers, a basic cable show that purported to investigate real haunted houses. I wasn't familiar with the program, but most of the gathered onlookers seemed to be diehard fans. One of the stars of the show, a man everyone was calling Petey, stood just behind the sawhorses, answering questions, signing autographs, and posing for selfies. "Who owns that house?" I asked Weird Al, pointing to our old A-frame. "No one now. The old guy who lived there killed himself. That's why they're here." The news made me feel strange. We'd bought that prefab kit. The house had been built for us. We'd spent summers and vacations there, and no matter what cosmetic changes had been added since, I knew every inch of that A-frame intimately. The thought that a man had committed suicide in one of our rooms left me feeling queasy inside. I wanted to hear more specifics, but a man with a megaphone announced, "Quiet on the set!" And everyone stopped talking. Petey had moved away from his adoring fans and was standing in the center of the street between Frank's house and ours. "We're here in Randall, Arizona," he intoned. "The most haunted town in America." The most haunted town in America? When had that happened? "Cut!" the man with the megaphone yelled, and they shot it again, from a different angle, then from another angle, before the megaphone man finally yelled, "Got it!" and workmen started moving equipment onto our old driveway, now covered with blacktop rather than gravel. I pushed my way to the front of the crowd. An attractive young woman on the other side of the barricade was texting on her cell phone, and I tapped her on the shoulder.
"Excuse me," I said. "Are you one of the ghost hunters?"
"Ghost pursuers," she corrected me.
"And yes, I'm Deb,"
she said in a tone that indicated I was supposed to know who that was.
"Well, I know a little bit about that house," I said. "My family built it. I used to spend my summers here."
Deb seemed far less interested in my story than in her texting. She moved forward so I could push a sawhorse aside and pass through the barrier.
"The producer and director are over there," she told me, pointing.
I walked past a group of men mounting a camera on a track to where a tall man with a gray Sam Elliott mustache was talking to a short, clean-cut younger man wearing earphones around his neck. I assumed they'd be talking about the show, but they weren't.
"Korean chicks love anal sex,"
the man with the mustache was saying. "Why?"
"Because it's painful and it's difficult to get through, and they think that makes it worthwhile. It's a cultural thing."
"So your girlfriend
every day."
The man's proud grin faded, and he scowled at my approach.
"Who are you and what do you want?"
He motioned to someone over my shoulder, indicating that I should be removed. "I'm a guy who used to live in that house when I was a kid. My dad had it built for our vacation home. And I know why that house across the street is haunted also. But if you don't want to hear about it..." I started to turn away.
"No, no, we'd love to hear your story."
He waved away the man he just called over to kick me out.
"What did you say your name was?"
"I didn't. And I'm not going to."
"That's fine, that's fine."
He was gesturing to someone else. Two bearded men in their early to mid-20s strolled over from where they'd been sitting on nearby chairs.
"I'm Scott Spencer, producer of Ghost Pursuers. These are our writers slash researchers, Evan and Owen. Tell them whatever you know, or let them interview you about what you know, and then maybe we can get you on camera as an expert, or a local expert, or we'll figure it out."
I wasn't about to appear on camera. It would erode my professional credibility. No one wanted to buy a home from someone who'd appeared on Ghost Pursuers talking about haunted houses. But I was definitely willing to provide them with background information. I'd never seen the show. And on air, the Pursuers might pretend to be the height of journalistic integrity, but off the air, the team responsible for the show was desperate for anything that would help them fill time. I could have lied through my teeth and told them a tale about the spawn of Bigfoot, and they would have used it. But as it happened,
I was legitimately able to fill in some gaps on stories the researchers had already unearthed. They told me that they were calling Randall the most haunted town in America, because of these two supposedly haunted houses situated directly across the street from each other. And I relayed the story of Frank and the dead dogs and the dead kid, although I left out any mention of Billy.
"We can stretch this to 2 episodes,
the producer said excitedly.
"That one house is small, so I didn't think we could get 22 out of it. But with this guy..."
He hooked a thumb in my direction.
"We might just be able to put in enough background that it'll cover up when our specter cams don't find anything. Which they never do,"
he confided to me. Evan and Owen looked at each other.
2 episodes?
Evan said.
"I don't see why not. We've done more with less."
"Yes,"
Spencer shouted. He rubbed his hands gleefully.
"This puts us at least half a week ahead."
"I want 2 new scripts from you ASAP,"
he told Evan and Owen.
"Leave the first 10 as is. We'll keep what we have for the initial foray, but prep the pursuers that the rest is being revised."
Barking orders, he headed toward Deb, still texting in front of the crowd, while he motioned for Petey and another man standing on the sidelines to join them. According to Evan, Will Grouse, the old man who'd been living in our house, had told friends and family for at least 2 months before he hanged himself that he'd seen and heard things he could not explain, and that he feared he was losing his mind. The place across the street, Frank's house, already had a reputation for being haunted, and had been vacant since the height of the recession, when the last owners had walked away from their mortgage and the bank had foreclosed. It was a neighbor from down the street, where Wyatt used to live, who had emailed ghost pursuers about the homes. Evan turned to me.
"We'll take you in with us," he said. "You show us around, let us know where the pursuers should train their cameras, where you found the dead dogs, where... Well, just tell us whatever you can about each room. I understand that you don't want to be on the show, but if you could feed us some info that another talking head could say, that would be great. Do you know the other house too?"
I nodded.
"Excellent. Then we'll cover them both."
Either sound carried, or the producer's ears were tuned to everything going on around him, because Spencer suddenly left Deb, Petey, and the other pursuer, and hurried over.
"We need you to sign a release before you go in," he said.
"Why?" I asked.
"Because we film everything, every interaction with the location, handheld, just in case we catch something. And if you happen to be in the shot, well, we need your permission if we incorporate it into the broadcast."
"No," I said.
"No?"
"No."
"Then you can't go in,"
I shrugged. "Then I won't tell you where the haunted parts are, and you won't know where to look. I suppose you could probably figure it out by trial and error. But time is money, right?" I met the producer's eyes. "Your call."
"Damn it."
He took a deep calming breath.
"Fine. Go in and show them what to look for. But film it,"
he ordered his crew. He turned his attention back to me.
"If we do see something, maybe you'll change your mind about participating."
"Doubt it."
"Make sure you keep him out of it, then. Over-the-shoulder shots only."
With Evan and Owen leading the way, and a ponytailed cameraman following right behind me, we made our way past a table covered with boxes of donuts, past groups of men setting up equipment, and up the steps to the deck of the A-frame. It had been a long time since I'd been here, but the boards felt the same under my feet, and my body's sense memory moved me forward as though I'd never left, and I'd been living here all my life. The house's paint was peeling, and a wrought iron security door had been added since my day, but the place was far more familiar to me than I would have expected it to be, and I felt a tightening in my gut as Owen held the door open and I walked across the threshold. We'd sold the house furnished all those years ago, and amazingly enough, our bookcase was still there, painted white now instead of stained walnut. The stove was the same too, although the refrigerator and all of the other furnishings were new to me. The couch was in the same spot as our couch, however, as was the coffee table. And while I knew that the small space offered only a limited decorating range, the continuity still made me feel more at home than I would have expected. My eyes kept glancing toward the spot in the hallway where the floor had collapsed, where Billy had been killed.
Feel anything?
Evan asked.
Sense anything?
I shook my head, not trusting myself to speak. In my mind, I could see my mom in the kitchen, cooking dinner, my dad on the couch reading a book. I felt tears welling in my eyes, and forced myself to remain focused on the present.
So where'd the old guy hang himself? I asked.
Owen pointed to the stairs leading up to the loft.
There, he said, from the top railing.
I wasn't sure I'd heard the second writer/researcher speak until this point. Looking up, I felt something. A slight sense of vertigo as my eyes found the A-frame's peak. Goose flesh rippled my arms as I started up the stairs. The loft that had been my brother's and my bedroom was now storage space. A cockroach scuttled under a pile of boxes as I turned on the light. There was definitely something here. It might have been from the suicide. It might have existed before. But the feeling in the loft was one of uneasiness. In my mind, unbidden, flashed the image of Irene, wrinkled, skeletal and grinning, hiding behind one of the piles of boxes, waiting for me.
Any stories about this floor? Evan asked.
I looked toward the back wall. There was only a narrow pathway through the center of the loft. The areas where our beds and dressers had been were entirely blocked by boxes. I wondered what had happened to all of my posters that had been left behind when we sold the place.
The hanging man should be enough, I said. Nothing happened up here?
A wave of something passed through me. It was a physical sensation, like thick, gummy air hitting me and moving on. I suddenly felt nauseated. I shook my head. Turning, I walked back down the stairs, pushing past the cameraman.
But if you're looking for ghosts, that's a good place to start.
I paused in the living room to catch my breath. The nausea had passed, but my heart was pounding. I was frightened, not in the abstract, intellectual manner of an adult, but in the direct, instinctual way of a child. Owen was frowning.
Did you sense something up there? It looked like you got scared or something.
I think I might have a touch of food poisoning, I lied. I just felt like throwing up for a second.
Nausea, Evan said. That's a good reaction. Make a note of that, he told his partner. Give it to Deb. Have her get nauseous.
We won't mention you at all, he assured me.
Don't worry.
I looked toward the spot in the hallway where the floor had collapsed, but quickly glanced away, knowing I needed to steer everyone away from that area. Not that I thought my brother's ghost was hanging around, waiting to be contacted. But if by some miracle such a thing were possible, I didn't want it to be with this crowd, and I didn't want it shown on TV.
How about the kitchen? Evan asked. The hallway? The bathroom? The back bedroom?
The bedroom, I said, though I'd never had any weird feelings about my parents' room. The dogs were under the bedroom. I led the way past the kitchen and down the short hall. As though on cue, a dog barked somewhere in the neighborhood, which wouldn't have seemed so creepy had not the temperature dropped a good 10 degrees the second we passed through the doorway. I glanced around to see if the others had noticed as well, and was relieved to see that they had. Evan was grinning.
Thank you, Jesus, he said. Finally, a real one.
That window might not be closed all the way,
Owen said in a half-hearted attempt to play devil's advocate.
It's warmer outside,
Evan snorted.
Not colder.
He looked at me.
Any stories here?
Just the dead dogs.
Good enough. We can milk this one. Why don't we go out and you can show us where you found the dog bodies, how it happened and all that.
10 minutes later, we were through. In a way, I thought, trudging back down the short driveway toward the street, it was better that all these people were here.
It allowed me to look at the house objectively and kept me one step removed from emotions that probably would have overwhelmed me had I been all alone. As it was, I was filled with a profound sense of loss as I recalled walking up this driveway with Billy and my parents for the first time. Scott Spencer broke away from a discussion with the director.
"Well, I still don't know if we can get 22 minutes out of it," Owen said. "It is a small house.
If we incorporate background."
"Maybe," Owen said doubtfully.
"You need more background information?" I asked. Spencer grinned.
"Lay it on us."
I told him about Frank's in-laws, George and Betsy, describing how their trailer had blown up in a propane explosion about the same time Frank and Irene had skipped town, and how their bodies had never been found. I was glad to be sharing this information and hoped they'd use all of it. I wasn't sure when this episode would air, but maybe Frank would see it. It was why I was cooperating with the program. While they might be using me, I was using them too. We were each getting something out of this. What would be Frank's reaction, though, if he did see the show? Nostalgia for the good old days? Would he be proud of his accomplishments? Or worried that someone was on his trail? Hopefully the latter. My goal was to scare him into making a move, doing something that would help me find him. I still wasn't sure what I would do if I did, but I reassured myself with the knowledge that there was no statute of limitations on murder, and I was pretty sure a modern forensics team could easily tie him to that dead boy in his basement. And maybe between now and then, I'd be able to dig up a few other things as well.
"Now check out the Lee house," Spencer told us. "See what you can come up with."
"Frank's place?" I said.
"What was this Frank's last name?"
the producer asked.
"Watkins," I told him. "The Watkins house," Evan said, trying it out. "That sounds better. The Watkins house.
Has a nice ring to it."
Spencer shook his head. "Too close to the Whaley house, which we just did last season. Stick to the script."
"The Goodwins lived there after Frank," I said helpfully. The producer snorted.
"Goodwins? That's not scary at all. Keep it the way it is."
The writers and I walked across the street, still shadowed by the cameraman. I hadn't been inside Frank's house for over 3 decades, but it looked almost exactly the same as I remembered. It felt the same.
"Jesus!"
Owen exclaimed the second he walked through the door. His partner looked over at him.
"You feel that too?"
"We all feel it," I said. "But that's only the beginning." I moved forward, glancing behind me, remembering the glimpses of movement I used to see in my peripheral vision, the dark shadow that slipped almost unseen from the entryway into the short hall leading to the master bedroom.
"I thought you guys checked this place out already."
"We didn't," Evan said. "Mark, yes, and the location scouts, and the director. But we're just the writers. We do as we're told." "This is a gold mine," Owen was saying.
I'd forgotten just how odd Frank's house was, with the doors in the wrong places and not where you'd expect them to be, the angles of the room slightly off in a way that wasn't actually noticeable, but that made you feel a little dizzy. The windows didn't let in as much light as they should, and as I remembered, directions seemed off in here, as though the inside of the building had a different orientation than the outside.
"Where's your stolen paneling?" Evan asked. "That's a good hook."
"Upstairs." But I didn't want to go upstairs. Being here was much more intense than I'd thought it would be, and compared to the relatively benign environment of our old vacation home across the street, much more malevolent. Malevolent. That was it exactly. There was a maliciousness here. This was not the vague, diffused air of the paranormal that hung about our A-frame, but a far more focused, concentrated, and intentional haunting. At the same time, my connection to Frank's place was much less personal, so I didn't feel the need to gloss over things or hurry through the rooms. In fact, I wanted to take my time.
I wanted to study Frank's house, learn from it. After all, this was not only a house he had built, this was where he'd lived.
So can we start upstairs and work our way down?
Evan asked. I nodded reluctantly, not trusting myself to speak.
Good blueprint for the show, too, Owen said, starting at the top, ending up in the basement where the body was found. We like to end shows with the cause of the haunting, Evan explained. That way, it's structured like a mystery, with a payoff at the end. Keeps viewers from switching.
There was a cold spot by the kitchen in the same place I remembered. Back then, we'd all ignored it, pretended we didn't notice it. But Evan and Owen moved around in it, commenting, trying to find its diameter, while the cameraman filmed it from every possible angle, hoping something would show up on playback.
Excellent, Evan said. There's another one upstairs, I said.
All right, lead on.
I didn't want to be in the lead. Even as an adult, even in the daytime, with three other men and dozens of crew members and onlookers on the street outside, I was as frightened as a child alone at night. Frank's house could do that. And not for the first time, I wondered how Mark and his family had been able to stay here. Whatever happened to Mark? I didn't know, and I'd never thought to find out. Obviously, the Goodwins had sold the house. But when? How long after we'd left? And where were they all now? Did they ever think about their days in Randall? Were they still in Randall? When I got back, I was going to see what I could discover, try to track Mark down. The narrow stairwell was dark. I started walking up, but after five steps or so, was filled with the overwhelming certainty that I was by myself and no one was behind me. I knew that wasn't possible, but I paused and looked back nevertheless, grateful to see Evan, Owen, and the cameraman. The sensation returned the second I turned around, though, and I had to force myself to continue up the stairs. At the top of the landing, I saw movement off to my right, in what had been Janine's room. There's something in there, I said, moving aside so the cameraman could get a look. He went in first, and Evan followed, flipping on the light as he entered. Owen stayed outside with me.
Do you see anything? I asked.
Not yet, Evan replied.
What did you think was in here?
I don't know. A figure. I thought I saw movement. I stepped forward, through the doorway, and a shadow detached itself from the darkness within the open, empty closet. Lurching into the center of the room, it jerked about like a spastic marionette, moving toward the cameraman as though drawn by the opportunity to reveal itself. Stumbling backward, then turning around in a panicked attempt to get away, I saw what looked like a woman reflected in the medicine cabinet mirror in the bathroom across the landing. An old woman. Irene. No. I looked quickly away, my eyes glancing toward the room that had been Mark's. I saw something sitting on the empty floor. A stunted, dwarfish figure with an oversized head rocking back and forth in time to some unheard music. I ran down the stairs. My heart was pumping so hard that I could feel it in my throat. I had no idea if the others were following me, and at that point, I didn't care. Speeding past the kitchen, through a cold spot, I ran out the front door and into the driveway, not stopping until I hit the street. Scott Spencer and several crew members, as well as the crowd of neighbors outside the barricade, watched me, surprised and curious. A few of the rougher-looking technicians wore mocking expressions, but the producer was ecstatic. He knew he had something good here, and he hurried over just as Evan and Owen emerged from the house, their faces blanched.
Well, he said, get the pursuers in there now, Evan advised. It's Amityville.
Spencer hurried off.
Petey! Deb! Ralph!
He was shouting orders to the makeup people even as he rounded up the stars. Abandoning their cranes and dolly tracks, cameramen, soundmen, and other crew members started scrambling. I frowned, noticing that our cameraman was missing,
Where's... I began.
Film in the basement, Owen said. That's one brave motherfucker.
He was right. There was no way in hell I'd have gone into that basement. Especially not alone.
I'm going to get my laptop, Evan told me. Then you can fill me in on everything you know about the place.
They're going in right now, I said. You're not going to have time.
It's a real one. They can just respond to what they see. And if they fuck up, we'll have better lines that they can re-record later. What we need from you right now is stuff for the background narration, to fill in the blanks between shots of the house.
The cameraman came out, well before anyone else was ready to go in, and he headed straight for Spencer. I followed Evan and Owen over, and we looked through the camera's small playback screen at the trip into Frank's. It unfolded just as we'd seen it. Although, it looked fake on the screen somehow. The shadow in Janine's room wasn't exactly cartoony, but it was well within what even a moderate television special effects budget could do. And I was surprised to find the scene so unbelievable. Spencer, however, was euphoric.
Even if we get nothing with the pursuers, we still have this. Home run, he announced loudly.
The cameraman didn't catch anything in the bathroom, but there was a slinking movement of shadow into Mark's closet, even though the dwarfish thing on the floor was gone. None of it looked particularly realistic. And I was not only disappointed, but confused as to why that should be. It was the reason, I supposed, that every piece of footage or photo of a ghost or UFO always proved so inconclusive, and I thought that maybe I'd been too quick over the years to dismiss claims of the supernatural. Oddly enough, it was the basement, where nothing had happened, that the feeling of Frank's house really came through. There were no moving shadows, no eerie figures, and even the section of wall where the mummified boy was found had long since been repaired. But when the camera zoomed in on a yellow vinyl chair that had been left behind by the house's most recent occupants, a wave of cold washed over me. The chair looked utterly ordinary, but something about it was fundamentally wrong, in the way all of Frank's house was wrong. And that sense leaped out of the frame at the viewer.
Wow, Evan said.
I was not the only one who'd noticed it. The cameraman nodded, shut off the playback.
That's why I left, he said. I got scared.
He met Spencer's eyes.
Make sure they go down in the basement. We'll get 10 minutes just out of that.
The producer was already leaving. He nodded in acknowledgement as he excitedly instructed the three ghost pursuers about what they needed to do once they were in the house. Evan glanced to the left at Frank's place, then to the right at our old A-frame across the street.
What's his name? The man who killed the dogs and the kid and built these buildings.
Frank, I said.
Jesus, he breathed. Who the hell was this guy?
That's what I wanted to know.